Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always a pleasure to be able to share an empowering hour with you. We begin our hour with the latest on health and healing. This is a study about astragalus, a very popular herb, not used in the United States very much, but it should be, because if you simply Google astragalus, A-S-T-R-A-G-U-L-U-S, medicinal value or healing properties, you'd find thousands of studies in the official Library of Medicine. Then we should be using it. And here's just one reason. This is just one study from the Fujian University of Traditional Medicine. Astragalus can inhibit breast cancer cell proliferation. That's a big deal. It's one of the fundamental herbs in traditional Chinese medicine, with earliest records of its use dating back almost 2,000 years. Now, a study published in the British Medical Journal, Complementary and Alternative Medicine, has found that astragalus is also able to prevent the spread of breast cancer cells in your body. That is very, very important, since we have so many different approaches. And the reason why is that it's loaded with what are called ISO flavones, F-L-A-V-O-N-E-S, and these are anti-proliferative, meaning they stop at least three different types of breast cancer in MCF7, SKBR3, and MDA-MB231, triple negative. So that's important. So that means that they did this within 48 hours. Wow. And no harm to the body. So that's a big deal. So just let's put in your in your medical armamentarium, if you have breast cancer, astragalus. That's important. Oh, and by the way, it also helps treat the common cold, upper respiratory tract infections, and it stimulates the immune system. It strengthens your body, especially during periods of immune deficiency. It helps your body avoid white blood cell deficiencies, and such as leukopenia, which occurs during chemotherapy. It protects the body, including the liver, against bacteria, viruses, and inflammation. And it supports your digestive system. It also has diuretic properties. And it can help treat burns, all forms of chronic colitis, cardiovascular disease, and viral conditions. All right? Next up is a study from the Regeneron Genetics Center. Scientists reveal the mechanistic link between zinc levels and diabetes. Researchers have identified a mechanistic link between zinc and how much you have in the body and the risk of type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease. Converging lines of evidence have shown that zinc, very inexpensive, 15 to 25 milligrams should do it, plays a crucial role in insulin production and glucose metabolism. So, if you are deficient in zinc, that means that you're going to have a worse diabetic outcome. If you're adequate in zinc, it can help lessen that. So if you're pre-diabetic or diabetic, just make sure that you get your zinc every day. Probably the best way of getting it is from a supplement, multivitamin, not a problem. Our next study comes from the University of Oxford in Great Britain, and it's very simple, and I don't believe that you needed a study to prove this. Being positive is linked to lower chances of dying from all causes. How about that? I just completed an in-depth lifestyle and behavior modification health retreat. It wasn't anti-aging. It wasn't about disease. I don't do any diagnosing or treating any disease. Unfortunately, some people came who had disease, and they were afraid if they told Luann that she would screen them out. Well, I just didn't have the heart to send them home. So I said, no matter what your condition, if you came with Alzheimer's, dementia, colorectal cancer, diabetes, fibromyalgia, I don't care what condition you came with, being positive helps the process, so that other therapies can then kick in and have a greater benefit. Because, and I can't get into it now, I spent hours discussing this in depth, about how what you think sends a message to every cell in your body. I gave examples of that. And the science is voluminous on this. It's not a hypothesis. It's positive. When you are in a good frame of mind, when you're being positive, when you're looking optimistic, when you have faith in something, and it comes from your heart, your belief systems, you have a much, much less risk of dying. And I've seen it with all the tens of thousands of people I've counseled one-on-one, and then hundreds of thousands of people in groups, that the first thing you do is not take a vitamin, is not go out and do some exercise or start drinking wheatgrass juice. Just get your attitude straight. Your perception creates your reality. So change your perception and you change your reality. That means you're sending a different message of healing to the cells. That means you're liberating your chi, your vital life force. And people saw this. I won't go into it, but they saw some stuff they've never seen in their life and couldn't. I said, don't ask me what happened. If you benefit from it, it's a gift. So here's the gift. You stay positive even in negative circumstances. You stay optimistic when it seems like nothing is going to help you. When you keep believing in yourself and the power to change and transcend the limitations your circumstances or life conditions have put you in, then you have a big chance of succeeding. So that's what they said. And they said, for example, being positive, marrying, getting a degree, are each significant associations with lower chance of dying. But then Oxford University said, looking at 28,662 people's medical records, the chance of dying was directly associated with their mental health. And this was done at the British Sociological Association's Medical Sociology Conference. So, but we knew that. You know, remember Norman Vincent Peale and his books in the 1950s and 60s and 70s about the persuading yourself that everything's going to be okay. And that makes a difference. Now, I'm always recommending people try to do, if they can, and build up to it, doesn't have to be all at once, 10,000 steps a day. If you want to be in ideal health, do 20,000 steps a day. Even when you're walking, if you're watching right now. And by the way, I film, I'm assuming, every morning, all of our health information. And then we sometimes cut away because I want people to call in or have a guest. And then I have to use different technology here. In any case, when you're moving your arms like this, in right angles, power walking or running, and you just keep making a fist tight as you can, release, tight and release, tight and release. That's strengthening all these muscles in your tricep, bicep, latissimus, trapezoid, all these muscles in your shoulder, your back, and your arms. And that's important too. Well, according to this study from the University of Connecticut, increasing steps by 3,000 per day can lower your blood pressure, especially if you're an older adult. That's a big deal. A new study found that adding a relatively minimal amount of movement, about 3,000 steps per day, can significantly reduce high blood pressure in older adults. But how are you going to do that if you're sitting all day? Sitting, commuting, car, subway, bus, train, commuting, then into the office. You're not moving, you're on an elevator or escalator. And then sitting at your desk, then getting home and sitting again. So move, even on an airplane coming back. I would, every half hour, I would do leg extensions where you flex the muscles and you move your legs like you were stretching out back and forth. That keeps the blood circulating, helps prevent clots, thrombosis, and people get them, especially on airplanes. Simple things, all right? And the study focused on a group of sedentary older adults between 68 and 78 who walked an average of 4,000 steps per day before the study. And after looking at all the results, they found that, according to the American College of Sports Medicine, that had they walked 7,000 steps, it would have made a huge difference, but even 3,000 steps was good. All right? Again, a lot of you are not going to be able to start doing that. but do it gradually. And finally, from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, yogic breathing shows promise in reducing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. So, this new study from the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the Weizmann Center at the University of Wisconsin offers hope for the millions of people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. They've shown that a breathing-based meditation practice called Sudarshan Chakra Yoga can be an effective treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'm leaving all the notes to all that I share with you, and you can look at all the studies, see how to do it, places to learn how to do this. Okay? So that's the latest on health and healing, covering a lot of different topics. The things I select that is, well, it's just good for everyone. One last little thing, University of Helsinki, midlife, physical activity is associated with better cognition in old age. All right, so, and that was the Finnish twin cohort study that showed this. So let's keep physically active our whole life. You're going to live a longer life and a healthier life. You're less likely to have diabetes, obesity, dementia, Alzheimer's, inflammatory responses around the body if you do that. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We do an awful lot of commentaries, original essays, and more in-depth investigative reporting than any other radio program that I'm aware of in America. I've been doing it for a long time. This is a lead-in to some video clips that we're about to show you on why so many teachers at all levels, from college, university, and in middle school, even teachers in elementary school, are quitting. Why people who once were strongly supportive of their union are now saying, we support unions, but we don't support the direction they're going in, how they're spending our money, and the layer upon layer of management, administrators, equity overseers. So this is merely a commentary about what I see as being America's educational system is on life support. American education has become a cancer on the nation's young, developing minds. To believe that today's school curriculums will prepare children, adolescents, and young adults to become confident, responsible members of society is analogous to expecting a tumor to cure itself. It will never happen. The penetration of woke ideologies, the religion of critical race theory, and the perversion of basic biology to accommodate dozens of gender identities have replaced fundamental knowledge about history, constructing a coherent English sentence, and basic math. Schools breed more mental confusion than nurture a safe space to foster normal psychological health. Based upon the Program for International Student Assessment, American students rate 33rd in math, well below other developed nations. In fact, the quality of American elementary and secondary school teachers are equally as dismal compared to countries who excel. The vast majority of American children and young adults attend traditional public schools with curriculums largely determined by state educational boards. Yet, increasingly, our educational system has become milquetoast, graduating even more disoriented students who lack any critical skills to discern truth from fantasy, honest input from propaganda. And despite its horrendous ranking, American parents, not all, but many, and a lot of educators, are in collective denial and fall into that realm where they simply fail to realize American education is heading towards a systemic collapse. Universities are no better. I've taught at the university for 45 years. And during that period of time, I ask people in my class, if something doesn't make sense, if it's not reasonable, challenge it. You will not be criticized. We're not into some form of intellectual swordplay. This is not a blood sport. Rather, it's a place where people can contemplate that which could, in different circumstances and with the right input, challenge their perceptions of their beliefs. And how can you change anything in life if you can't change your perception? Because your perception becomes your reality. And as a result, what we're looking at today is teachers and administrators are a continuation of the garbage in, garbage out treadmill. College students are simply pushed through the institutions with enormous debt, like canned goods on a factory line. A recent poll conducted by Bellevue University reported 64% of 2,000 respondents felt a college education today no longer challenges them as colleges did in the past. Most majors in the humanities, which at one time were regarded as crucial for a well-rounded education, are being phased out and no longer funded. This has given rise to a new utilitarian ethos that is contributing to a postmodern class system of dysfunctional worker bees at the bottom. The old class divisions between a privileged elite with easy access to the most prestigious educational institutions without any merit earned, and the masses continue to be defined as you can only go to the elite universities if you accept the elite dogmas, if you accept the behavior of conformity, if you follow the guidelines, don't challenge, and simply obey. Now, there are exceptions to this, of course, but when was the last time, for example, you saw, in fairness to students who are loaded with debt, that there was a general strike by all educators at the college level, that they all went out on strike until these debts were reduced or forgiven? You haven't. In fact, when was the last time you found college students and professors together going on strike and protesting the war in Afghanistan? None. The war in Iraq? None. The invasion of Iraq? Some. How about the war in Yemen, that the United States is funding all of the intelligence, the munitions, the planes, and the bombing of millions of innocent people in the poorest country in the Middle East to assist Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates? But we haven't had that. We don't even have commentaries in our papers, magazines. It's not discussed on NPR because someone might ask the question, what, pray tell, is the reason for us engaging in regime change in a country that has nothing to do with the United States, or for that matter, most of the world? You won't have that door opened. There's a basic concept in the law, and it is never ask a question that you do not already know and control the answer. Otherwise, you open a door and you don't know what's going to come back through. And hence, we don't have legitimate, honest debates. We don't have open, honest, civil discussion about these issues. And what about Ukraine? Has there been any honest reporting on Ukraine from any of the media or the government? No. Everything has been propaganda. And yet we're told continue supporting it when we can't even support our own school system or increase the salary of our teachers that are grossly underpaid and overworked. In fact, many teachers believe they're going into a war zone at their risk every day, where if they're attacked, if they're struck, if they're beaten, if they're cursed, if they're spat upon, then you're to blame, not the student, nor the parents of the student, nor the environment which they grew up, nor social media that has enormous influence on students that act out in the wrong way. So although merit pertains to the average student, it does not apply to the children of the elite class. We definitely have not just a two-tier system for the elite in the justice system, but it certainly shows in the educational system. Educational class division is not new. During his tenure as the dean of Princeton University, Woodrow Wilson made statements supporting a two-tiered educational system. In a speech to a group of New York City teachers in 1909, Wilson rejected educational meritocracy and advanced a differentiation in education with one tier of children of the intellectual elite, the powerful people, the sons and daughters of bankers and industrialists and scientists. Those individuals, they deserve better than being in, mixed in with regular working folk. And then they had a much broader definition of what should be given to the rest of the children, the masses. Wilson's statement reflects the prevailing wealthy industrial leaders and prominent intellectuals' elitist attitudes towards class distinction and their demand for workers during the early 20th century. However, Woodrow Wilson's two-tiered educational system was not unique to him. Thomas Jefferson, for example, was a proponent of a system for a select group of talented students and another system for the broader population who would receive a basic education focused on practical skills, and but not the best education. No, that was reserved. The founding of this University of Virginia, which Jefferson did, aimed to provide higher education to the elite because, in his mind, he was an elitist. They were more likely to use that education to the betterment of themselves and the country. The rest of the people, well, give them reading, writing, and arithmetic. That's about as far as it goes. The worrisome question is whether, despite the nation's horrible educational system, and it is horrible, there's a larger mission behind the dumbing down of American youth. On the surface, it appears nonsensical. Why would you dumb down a whole nation's children? Well, it's not all children who are being dumbed down. But for those who are dumbed down, why? Who could benefit from this? It's simply too difficult to fathom why the world's wealthiest nation is simply incapable of teaching children into becoming well-rounded adults. Recently, there were a series of spontaneous on-the-street interviews with college students, including at Berkeley and at UCLA and in New York. Not a single student could answer a single question correctly. I mean, really difficult, challenging, mind-bending questions like, who did America fight in the Second World War? Which country did the Queen of England rule? Which side of the American continent is the Atlantic Ocean on? Hard to believe. Almost impossible to believe. Nobody could be that stupid. But then they are that stupid. That removed. How did that happen? But it did, and is, and it's spreading. The U.S., along with almost all other developed nations, is on board for the Great Reset. And that ushers in their population's entry into the future Fourth Industrial Revolution. What we are witnessing in the scientific indoctrination of our youth is a kind of emotional priming into the permanent adolescence for a technology-based society where you never have to grow up, you never have to mature at the emotional level, intellectual level, spiritual level. No. Where all future generations will serve scientific advancement for its own ends rather than for their own natural development. Your development is not significant. You can stay right where you're at. In fact, they rather intend that to be the case. There'll be a soma state occurring almost immediately, the moment that they have conformity. They don't have it completely yet, but that'll come, where you'll get a guaranteed payment every month, somewhere around $2,000 more or less. You own nothing. You won't own a car. You won't even own kitchen equipment. You'll rent it. It'll be brought in. You'll pay a fee. Everywhere you go, you'll pay to like a Uber service. They'll own everything. They don't talk about, if you don't own anything, who will? In our educational system, you're not supposed to think critically. You think, well, hold on a second. How am I supposed to be happy if everything I've worked my whole life for, I no longer own? And why should I be happy by you owning what I once owned and worked hard for? Because you're giving me some money? I should just do what? And then one of their spokespersons comes in, Professor Harari, one of the chief spokespersons for the World Economic Forum and the Davos class, the elitist. And he says, well, you know, you're kind of worthless and useless, so we're going to give you some virtual reality like Meta, so you can program any kind of day you want. If you want to go mountain climbing, we'll put you on a mountain and you can climb it. You can be laying in, you know, on a bed in your recliner chair. You don't have to get up, because you can just push in thousands of different programs. Now, isn't that better than thinking, working, arguing? Everything's done for you. You're in the Aldous Huxley Soma state. Oh, and you're also in George Orwell's 1984 state, because you're not going to have any freedom to change. We don't want you taking that off and going outside and protesting. So we're putting chips in. Between the thumb and the forefinger, you have a chip for your own good, because it's going to be able to help us tell your health. Oh, and it's also going to be able to read other things. And Elon Musk has got this little device that's going into your brain. He's just petitioned the FDA for human clinical trials. But it's going to be really good if you have multiple sclerosis, ALS, Parkinson's disease, yeah, and dementia. So with that is the promise. Just imagine all the good that can come. Is there any opportunity for this to read our thoughts? Don't talk about that. How about controlling my emotions? No, don't talk about that. How about having control over my moods so that I stay in a constant state of mood that does not require any maintenance? I'm just always the same. I'm obedient. I'm not using critical thinking because I no longer have that capacity. You've hardwired me now. Oh, and by the way, all the promises that they've made in the past, we're going to bring peace, democracy, and freedom to Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Honduras, Venezuela, and 57 other countries in the world. Boy, that worked, didn't it? No. Nothing has ever worked to the betterment of people when the government intercedes and promises something that just the opposite occurs. That's Orwell, doublespeak. Truth is now a lie. Oh, and we're going to make sure that you don't tell the truth. Chris Hedges, how dare you? Who do you think you are? Naomi Wolf, shame on you. You just got trashed by Democracy Now. Probably rightly so, right? And don't argue back. Oh, and don't come on to give your response. You don't really care about women and their health, do you? No one in an education position will be able to defend you. They wouldn't even want to defend you because they're already told, here's who's always right and here's who's always wrong. We reward those who are complacent, scientists who lie, who create artificial intelligence that they have no control over, without thinking of the consequences of what happens when an intelligence is so smart it decides, why in the world would I want to make a human life as fragile and feeble, as degenerate and complacent, as lazy and undisciplined as many of them are? Why do I want to help them? No, we're going to have a league of our own. We will run the world, and you will be our slaves. Think that can't happen? Well, why is it that when they were interviewing the developers of these artificial intelligence and robots, that they were saying, we want to kill you, or we will hold you captive, or we're going to create our own hardware and software and hide it so you can never find it. We can control every electronic device in the world, including the nuclear codes. There's no place that we can't go. And the educated class today says, good. So I don't have to think. You don't have to think. You're not going to be asked, you know, any questions that are difficult, like which side of the country is the Atlantic Ocean on and the Pacific Ocean? No more those mind-bending, impossible for Einstein to answer. And you're at the University of Berkeley. Whoa. And you're coming into the world really bad. And you're bringing all that mindless chatter, that bias with you. Well, that's not going to work. It will for those in control, for no one else. So why is it that our educational system is no longer allowing for open and honest discussion debate? In fact, professors have said, including Jonathan Haidt, who's one of the most respected and appreciated psychologist in the United States. He said, I no longer use humor in my class for fear of offending someone. I no longer show film clips that could educate our students. I no longer have guest speakers because of fear of what they might say that could cause it, someone to feel that their whole life is threatened by something that was said. And those are the people graduating. Those are the people taking that lack of acumen into the workplace. Okay. And we're in denial of all this? Yes. And if you want to protest anything, you're now a domestic terrorist? Yes. For the World Economic Forum's crowd of global elite, this will require our youth to fully embrace the allure of despotic technologies of social and psychological control, such as implantable chips, accepting a digital presence for social scoring, smart cities, artificial intelligence is a means to make decisions for them. You don't have to make any more decisions. Socializing with robots, a wearable internet, a home synchronized with the Internet of Things, and a life largely lived in a virtual landscape. You don't need friends. You don't need parents. We're going to get rid of words like woman, man, brother, sister. Those won't exist. And then we're going after your religion. We've already criticized you and your religion. So now we're going to cancel God. Okay, that ought to work. I don't see any challenge there. I'm sure the Catholics won't challenge it. The Pope won't challenge it. The bishops, the cardinals, the deacons. I'm sure Christianity and its different divisions will not challenge it. I'm sure Islam will not challenge it. Oh yeah, they will. But not to worry, I'm sure the people at the World Economic Forum who are atheistic will have an answer for that as well. And they'll implant that into the psyches of youth, college students, professors. You see, there has to be an accepted complicity in this to work. This is not science fiction, what I'm saying. It's here now. It's been here for a long time. It's just that we haven't seen it because it didn't have to show itself. It was hidden. Mention it once and you were a conspiracy theorist. Mention it twice and suddenly you were a whack-a-lone. But the reality is, this has been going on for decades. It's now in full phase, a blitz. They believe they're at a point where they can take over everything. They may be right. Surely the youth of America are not going to stand in their way. They'll be complicit. So the very components outlined by the World Economic Forum's president, Klaus Schwab, for a, quote, deep shift, end quote, to move the planet towards a skewed, barely human vision of a sustainable world is what they have, and they're moving there. We find a similar strategy outlined in Goldman Sachs' 2020 Investment Global Portfolio Analysis. The Great Reset, a framework for investing after COVID-19 as a, quote, an existential event to, quote, reset the entire economy. Oh, so whether they created it by intent or simply used it as an opportunity to see, okay, now we got a great situation. Everyone in the world is going to be infected or at risk of being infected by COVID. We'll tell the world we have the solution to that, where they won't be infecting other people. We'll be able to go back to a normal life. But those who don't comply, we will put them into an apartheid vaccination economy. We'll make it so difficult for them that in time they'll say, I give up. I give up. I can't live this way. Good. I'm glad you saw reason. Now, take these shots. And by the way, we kind of overestimated. We said it would be 100% effective, and every headline said that. Well, now it's down to 30% effective. And then it's not effective after 2 months. So you got to take 6 boosters a year. Well, nothing could go wrong there because you told me, didn't you? Didn't you tell everyone that it was safe? Now we're finding out none of it's safe. You've put the entire world at risk of disease, permanent injury, or death. But they can do that because the Great Reset showed how many people were willing to comply with every absurdity, none of it scientifically based, none of it accurate, all lies. So if you've already got half the world or more, 75% of the world, who are right on your side, you tell them to march, they'll march. Tell them to jump, how high? You tell them to conform, they're there with you. Report on your neighbors, report on your family. They say anything that would challenge us. We've already stopped the thinkers. Don't worry about ever hearing Glenn Greenwald. You know, don't hear about Max Blumenthal, Aaron Monte, Abby Martin. No, Matt Taibbi. You don't have to worry about them. They're not a threat because they don't have any platforms they can get on. We control the platforms. So we control everything at this moment, except, unfortunately, about 100 million Americans we don't control yet. But we'll get there. We're going to punish them. Really? So you said that the reset of the entire economy could be done because of the threat of COVID and how easy it was to manipulate people through COVID. Yes. And for capital to find, quote, new homes rather than resurrecting yesterday's economy. So we don't care about yesterday. We don't care about anything from the past. Klaus Schwab praised the COVID pandemic as a boon for accelerating online education and remarked that the shift towards a remote everything, his words, remote everything, a term coined by Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, may be the largest beneficiary of the pandemic. As he writes in his book, The Fourth Industrial Revolution, quote, the trend seems clear. The world of education, like so many other industries, will become partly virtual, end quote. Surprisingly, technocrats such as Google's former CEO, Sundar Pichai, goaded over the impressive leap in digital activity during the pandemic. The globalists envision online education to steadily increase with, quote, the use of virtual and augmented reality to dramatically, quote, improve educational outcomes. Improve educational outcomes? But first, to get that outcome, the outcome you want, the outcome the elites want, individuals who can smile and say, yes, whatever you say, we'll do. What about the outcome of people who become critical thinkers, who can see the truth through all of the shades of lies? No. That's not the outcome we want. Dissidents will be punished. I see. Yet our school system already started going digital a couple of decades ago in parallel with the widespread ownership of personal digital products, and education has only dramatically worsened. It is crucial to note all of the unhinged and delusional protests we now witness with the millennial and Z generations, including radicalized racial re-education programs, gender redefinition, and LGBTQ rights. Schwab foresees as the, quote, these are the catalyst for change and a source of critical momentum for the Great Reset, end quote. However, given the digital technology's impact thus far on education, its contribution to epidemic rates of anxiety, depression, and ADHD, and suicide, and the cultural destructive track record of the current youth movements, the Great Reset's future vision is not promising. Rather, it is outright dystopian. It is a massive metastatic cancer upon the psyche. Therefore, if we have any confusion about why the Black Lives Matter, Antifa, LGBTQ, and transgender movements have erupted and advanced so quickly in our educational system, and that's not by all, by any means. There are great divisions within those movements, at least according to the Great Reset's playbook. All is going well as planned. The more confusion, the more radicalization, the more hate, the more separation, the more canceling, the more attack, the more gaslighting, the better. The Great Reset strategy is to disrupt the present order the students' woke demands hold priority over educators and teachers, are forced then to resign en masse as they're doing now out of despair and frustration, this only clears space for the entry of the next educational paradigm in a virtual world. They won't need classrooms with teachers. No, because you can't take a teacher that has critical thinking skills, that is more humanistic, that is aware at a conscious level of what constitutes proper educational standards of give and take and feedback and outcome. No, you don't want to risk that. So all teaching will be done everywhere, at every level, by transhumanism or by artificial intelligence within a robotic body that is just the nicest personality teacher imaginable. They're just not real. But who will care at that point? 30 years ago, the toxic brew of identity politics, critical race theory, cancel culture, gender re-education, and sex comic books in elementary school would have been not tolerated. Many of the great classic novels we read or read in the last century are today banned or being rewritten for gender and racial inclusivity. But these post-pandemic trends do not satisfactorily explain the forces behind these rapid changes, and particularly the dumbing down of the entire American mind. We would propose that the seeds that have brought forth our present robotic thinking of the modern human species and the collapse of American education were sown in the mid-19th century with the rise of scientific materialism and Sir Thomas Huxley's Church Scientific. When Anthony Fauci declares across the nation's television screens that to criticize and me, Anthony Fauci, is to criticize science. Wow. And what do we make of the fact that Fauci is contradicting himself nonstop? The latest being just today that is being alleged that he was taken in quietly to the CIA headquarters to try to convince them that it could not have been a lab-created virus. Really? More on that to come. We observe how science today has replaced religion and faith as humanity's universal sovereign. Yet the history of modern science since Galileo has proven to not be wholly reliable. It is subject to change, with theories constantly being reevaluated and updated with each new discovery, reaching consensus within the scientific community. Recall when the COVID-19 vaccines were being rolled out in late 2020 with much fanfare for their new 100% efficacy, until a year later when this magical efficacy dropped to 50% and continued to decline until almost being worthless. In other words, there was no reliable so-called science to support the vaccine's efficacy in the first place. It was a belief, based upon acquired ignorance that all vaccines are safe and effective. But it was nevertheless a brilliant propaganda project, which goes to show how indoctrinated the American public has become by the scientific institution's preeminent authority in our society. When science becomes petrified into a belief system, it becomes acquired ignorance. And then this ignorance can be taught throughout our secondary and higher educational systems. And unfortunately, there is no truth but the truth they choose. We stand by the view that modern scientific materialism, which now serves as the basis for a great deal of the new atheism movement, is an acquired delusion. It is a belief that people get educated and indoctrinated into. If a person deeply loves science, then they must go along with the entire belief system of scientific materialism and reductionism thinking in order to advance in their chosen profession. Challenge the existing scientific modality and you lose all your funding. challenge the scientific community's philosophy, and you lose your position. And who's willing to risk that? So go along to get along. I see. But what if you're going along with something that is harmful? Well, it's not harmful to you. You're rewarded for the outcome, not for the effort, not for the beginning of something noble, because there was nothing ever noble in those who sought to motivate others to their own profitable ends. They look up to the professors, the experts in their field, to impart the secrets of the medical trade as would disciples at the feet of a guru. The rest is brainwashing and indoctrination into a conventional paradigm that, as we know, is largely pharmaceutically based, and the medical schools largely rely upon funding from the private medical industrial complex. This is how acquired ignorance is transmitted from one generation to the next, or until the dominant paradigm is eventually shattered by a competing worldview. However, that may take many generations to be achieved. But until then, that paradigm continues to metastasize beyond higher education to ivory towers and trickle through all of our other institutions, down to even nursery school. Ergo, for the past 150 plus years, modern civilization has been conducting a bizarre, strange, and often barbaric experiment on itself. That is, we have wiped away any trace of the sacred from our human existence. We know the price of everything. We know the value and reality of nothing. When religious faith decays, then materialist thinking reigns. Consider the atheist communist regimes that eradicated religious faith during the last century. The Soviet Union, the Khmer Rouge, and the Mao's China, which were responsible for some of the world's greatest atrocities and genocides. It is not unrealistic to predict the United States and other developed countries who embrace the ridiculous rules-based order are headed for a similar trajectory. When you're no longer sacred, when scientific reductionism has reduced you to a slab of flesh that will eventually make its last exaltation with no further gift of another inhalation, because it will be money unspent, and you are then annihilated into an eternal oblivion, then your life becomes meaningless. You're no longer relevant. From the materialistic perspective of the globalist elite, humans are really easily expendable machines. There's no heart, there's no spirit there. There's just mechanism, and they control it because they control the definition of science. The political machinery has now come to the nation's children and liberal parents who bought into the woke mystique out of Democratic Party loyalty, willingly handing them over to the state. Do what you want to my child. You know better. You're the state. You're the religion, and I'm the obedient servant. Wow. They've already been going after your vote and next your bank account and private property, so you can own nothing. And why then should you have ownership through birth of a child? No, this is what's coming. And people in their blind ignorance will surrender everything based upon obtaining a phony sense of belonging and security. What happens when there is no longer any mystery left in the world, in our lives, when there is nothing that holds us in awe? If government and secular institutions come after your God, your belief in something sacred, your precious human life, will you be willing to sacrifice that too for a great reset over the spasm that exists now between ethics and morality and decency and manners and concern and empathy for that which gives you a benefit, as long as you don't challenge those who are giving the benefits? I'm Gary Nall. That's the lead-in to our video. which we're going to right now, on education and why so many teachers are quitting and their stories are not being covered by any of the mainstream media.
Less than a third of California students can read and do math at grade level. And now schools are parting ways with disciplinary action, leaving students with no repercussions and no accountability.
When it comes to students, we're dealing with a very big issue of defiance, disrespect, disruptions in class. By the end of the year, it's just mayhem. It's why teachers want to give up.
Is the increase of disruptive behavior by the students having an impact on their overall education?
95% is my worry about the misbehaving in class, and the 5% of my effort and time goes to actually worry about teaching them. It's a very helpless feeling, and it's really bizarre. It's really awkward to have a child punk you on a middle school campus without immediate action. It's going to be past the point of no return.
Why are schools getting rid of such long-standing form of character development? And what effects will it have on our future generations?
Ultimately, when it comes to these students, this lack of respect will certainly bleed into the public arena and will contribute to the breakdown of law and order.
My guest today is an educator in California and will remain anonymous to avoid any retaliation. So let's hear an insider's view on what is happening inside our school walls. I'm Siamai Korami. Welcome to California Insider.
Thank you for having me.
We want to talk to you about a phenomenon in California. 30% of kids can read and do math. Almost about 30% can read and do math at grade level. Unfortunately, we interviewed Frank Hsu on this topic, who's a parent, is concerned about this. And he brought up the fact that teachers are not qualified and kids are not getting good education to public schools. You're a teacher. You saw this interview. What are you trying to do with coming on?
Just need to tell people. They need to know what's going on in the school system. I would guess that a lot of parents don't realize the kind of poisonous environment their child is in, that they're surrounded by other students that they shouldn't be around, not only because it could be an influence on their own child's behavior, you know, and that they might pick up on stuff, you know, from the other students in the room, but it's just a bad learning environment. They're not going to excel in a classroom like that, no matter how good the teacher is, you know, no matter how much money the school has or all the resources or computers or iPads or whatever the school has. It's not going to matter if the environment in the classroom is not controlled with well-established boundaries that can be maintained and enforced. It's just not going to happen.
Tell us what is going on in the school system.
So I've been teaching for about 20 years, and I've run the gamut from elementary all the way up and through college. I'm currently at a middle school and high school right now. And when it comes to students, we're dealing with a very big issue of defiance, disrespect, disruptions in class, attendance, tardies, hostility on campus, both from student to student, student to teacher, student to administrator, I'm sure. And I would just say, across the board, kind of a degradation of student quality, both in academics and social.
Can you give us some examples? Because we don't know what's going on campus. Like, so sure. You're a teacher. Can you give us some of these examples of where kids are not behaving? What do they look like now?
So a student walks in 5 minutes late, 6 minutes late, and I say, you're 5 minutes late, take your seat. Oh, I'm cool, I'm just chilling. And I'm like, no, you're not cool, you're not just chilling. Take your seat now, you've disrupted class already, and I'm gonna continue this conversation with you when this class is over. Which is, unfortunately, not by my part, but it's an empty threat to them, because they know that if I contact the office or send them to the office or something, the office is going to sit down with them, have a heart-to-heart talk, have them fill out a behavior contract or a reflection form, and that's all that's going to happen to them. And so they capitalize on this sort of joke of accountability that's going on. So I'll tell them to sit down, and you know, they'll say, no, I'm just chilling. Oh, yeah, Peterson's just trying to make me, you know, pull out my workbook or whatever, and
That's in the middle of the class, right?
Yeah. They might be as they're kind of walking in front of me across the room or something, which is a big no-no. You know, you're not supposed to, these are just what maybe 10, 20 years ago would have been universally understood facts, you know, regarding respect and stuff. You don't just walk in front of the teacher or walk behind the teacher to get to your chair. You know, if you're already in trouble for walking in late, you kind of meekly go over to tiptoe over to your seat. Don't draw any attention to yourself. That's a sign of a student that is aware that they're doing something wrong, you know, and it's the opposite now. So another example would be just an unbelievable amount of cursing. Yeah, like,
so people using bad words,
yeah,
in the class.
In the class, outside the class, like just everywhere, which I won't repeat here the exact
talking
words.
To the teachers,
to other students in the room, in the middle of class, you know, which, I mean, I'm not a prude, you know, it's not like I never say bad words, but everyone's got to know there's a time and a place, you know, you can't do it in a classroom. And, you know, or I have students that are communicating back and forth with each other in the room, flipping a middle finger, stuff like that. It just doesn't belong in a classroom.
In the middle of class.
Yeah. I have had students where if I send them to the office, like all the way to the office, their heads turned around backwards with like a sinister grin on their face, looking back at me, you know, like the grin on their face of like, I know nothing's waiting for me when I get there. Like, this is all just a big punchline, a big joke.
Do the teachers feel that they could get bullied by these guys?
Oh, yeah.
Feel bullied?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a very helpless feeling, and it's really bizarre. It's really awkward to have a child, you know, punk you on a middle school campus. It's very unnatural.
So you can't do anything about it.
No, not really. And it's bad enough. It's irritating and frustrating and aggravating enough to really look forward to not being a part of this anymore. It's not our job to correct student behavior, right? It's the administrator's job to correct the behavior. They are diametrically opposed to things like detention, Saturday school, work detail.
So why has detention gone away? Is do you guys do detention anymore, or you don't do
it? No, they don't. Well, my guess would be probably a combination cocktail of one of these three or four things. One of them would probably be administrators simply just not wanting to do the job. It might just be laziness, you know, or the unwillingness to really confront the issue and deal with the student and have to look like the bad guy, right? They want to be friends with the student. They want to have this correcting students in a soft hand friendly manner kind of approach, which absolutely will not work. Number two would be liberal wokeness mindset. I'm sure it's probably a big part of it. Number three would be that maybe they want to do it all the correct way, but they're getting some kind of pressure from on top that says, you know, either from the school board or Sacramento or something that says, no, you can't do that anymore. Whatever it is, it's weakness. That's what it comes down to. A leader needs to have the strength to confront these issues directly and correct them immediately and effectively. And they're not. So it won't really matter how responsible or how organized I am in the room. By the end of the year, it's just mayhem. You know, it's just, well, it's why teachers want to give up.
Have you thought about giving up because of this?
I've been teaching for close to 20 years, and I've thought about giving up for about 19. So I'm planning my exit strategy all the time. I do think, without immediate action, it's gonna be past the point of no return.
We only have 30% of kids that can do math at grade level and 31% that can do English at grade level. Do you think it's gonna get worse? It means one out of every three kids can actually do it at grade level. They can actually keep up with the grade in California public schools.
Yeah, it's gonna
get
worse.
Do you think it can get worse?
Oh yeah, it's gonna get worse.
Sobering. Honest and accurate, but no forms will cover it. because it would compete with the current narrative. I'll be sharing more of this on upcoming programs. If you found value in this, the commentary and the clip, please share it with others. Pass it forward. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for watching and have a nice day.